This is Classic Business with Michael Avery on Classic 1027 in Gauteng and FMR in Cape Town.
Well, it's just gone 29 minutes to 7 here on Classic Business. And the big question right now in 2019 has to be, where is South Africa going? And more importantly, will we survive as a constitutional democracy? And we've got Zimbabwe's flames licking at our borders as a timely reminder of just how thin the line of policy choices is between prosperity and misery. After another week of the Zondo Commission, which has left certainly has left me feeling quite despondent and disillusioned, as we see a lot of what we had suspected really confirmed by Angela Agretsi, the whistleblower, and really wondering where the moral compass has gone in South Africa. Where's the policy compass led us? And someone who's dedicated his professional life to wrestling with these questions is Frans Cronier, who is the CEO of the South African Institute of Race Relations and a noted scenario planner. Frans, great to see you again.
Nice to be here, Michael.
And we're joined too tonight by Kwebi Lekhrunji, who's a strategist and co-founder at Rexalong Invest. Kwebi, it feels like it's been a really long time since we last spoke. I almost forgot what you looked like. How are you doing? Happy New Year.
Mike, thanks, man. When last did I do the show? I think it must have been October last year.
Yeah, but when you're doing the show, I'm not here. We haven't been doing the show together for a very, very long time. So great to see you again.
Thank you for joining me.
And to talk about this big picture question. And Frans, I'm sure you must be fielding this question a lot right now as we build into that general election. Where are we going?
Yeah, we segment the answer a bit. The politics, we're doing a vast amount of polling. And the sense that we're getting is ANC somewhere near 60. The DA will do well to retain its performance of 5 years ago, the EFF somewhere around 10. Now, there's a view in the community that at 60, Mr. Ramaphosa gets a mandate, and the mandate opens the way to reform. We're not convinced for two reasons. One is that it misunderstands the basis of change, that change is created by pressure. And if the pressure of a political defeat is removed, we don't see how that necessarily strengthens the hand of reformers in the ANC. It might just as well strengthen the hands of more destructive elements in the party that will say, see, we can do expropriation. There is no political price to be paid yet. Second reason why we're unconvinced is internal within the ANC itself. There's too much overlap between the executive committee and the cabinet itself. And reform presupposes, therefore, that members of the National Executive Committee will be prepared to reform themselves. And the short-term price of that is simply too great. So the political world, ANC at 60, very little change comes after that. In the social world, I think as people look to the idea of the new dawn and possible reform, they tend to understate some of these socio-economic risks. Half of young people don't have a job. 1.2 million kids enrolled in matric, enrolled in grade one 13 years ago, but 50,000 of those will get a good maths pass in matric now at the end of their careers. And there's a strong relationship between your level of education and your level of unemployment. So we don't break the structural unemployment crisis. That means high levels of youth economic exclusion. That means high levels of social instability. At a moment when we think the ANC is likely to be less inclined to reform than if it did very badly in an election. Third level of analysis for us is what is happening in the policy world. And the scorecard there isn't good a year into the Ramaphosa administration. Minimum wage legislation is one hard example we can look at now. Simply prices a great many unskilled young people out of jobs. And you can say as much as you want to that the minimum wage will help to create jobs. It's a fallacy. It will not do that. I think great damage has been done in the manner in which the government has promoted the idea of expropriation. And even moderates within the ANC who say, give us a chance and watch how we implement it, they will even concede that many in the investment community are likely to wait and see how that implementation happens before investment takes off, and if it should it take off. And if the implementation isn't a walk back on expropriation, then that investment is unlikely to materialize. Then you get the tier that deals with ideology itself. And we get the question from clients who say, but isn't it possible? Do they not see where this may be going if these pieces, as you stack them together, come together? And that's not our experience. We find that policymakers in the ANC understand quite well what is happening in the country and what the implications are. They will not argue the need for change or policy reform, dramatic reform, but they're unable to bring about reform. And part of the reason for that is this overlap between the NEC and the cabinet, and that the consequences of real reform would be to put very often yourself and your slate of comrades out of a job, deny you access to the state and therefore the cash flow to hold the organization together. And sometimes the lack of movement on reform therefore is justified in terms of ideology, commitment to an ideology adopted by the ANC in the late 1960s called the National Democratic Revolution, which essentially holds that the purpose of anti-colonial revolutions must be to dispossess the elite, the middle classes, the capitalist class before the poor can be free. And we see a lot of evidence that under pressure, the ANC is reverting to this ideology. And perhaps the best example, recent example, is the policy manifesto released by Cyril Ramaphosa. So our sense for this year, reform unlikely to materialize. Weak economic performance continues. Socioeconomic pressures continue to build on the country. What comes from there is we're open on. Does that eventually force reform is a possibility, but we find it very difficult to buy into the perhaps overly simplistic analysis that wait until May and things will begin to come right.
The good guys will triumph over the bad guys. It has been fairly binary and fairly simplistic up to this point when we have looked to this new administration and its reform agenda. Reading through the manifesto, Kirby, was bewildered. I was bewildered for a number of reasons. But reading through the document, you see a ruling party that is still very wedded from its internal policy perspectives to the state as the central lever by which to transform South African society. So we're talking about a state-owned pharmaceutical company. We're talking about setting up worker co-ops where workers now own stakes in their companies, and nothing mentioned about how that will be funded. But what we still see is something that is very far left of what would be the center of economic policy. If we were to step back and say globally, put that manifesto on a table in Europe, it would definitely be in the camp of Labour or even left of that. Yet here we have the ANC that sells itself as the moderate party. Right now they're winning the battle of ideas. How do you see 2019 playing out?
Well, I was going to say that France is a ray of hope here this evening, but I can see that that is not going to be playing itself out. I think, look, I mean, I want to second what a lot of what Francis has spoken about, and Mike, I think you've spoken about it, is that there's more questions that remain rather than answers, and the election isn't necessarily going to be this turning point where suddenly we're going to have all these answers and that suddenly we're going to have a very different investment in environment. There was a time in this country where we almost had a Goldilocks moment. Post 1994, it was the Mandela magic that occurred. We started to coincide that with monetary policy and with fiscal policy that became a lot more prudent. And when that occurred, we saw growth. And the growth coincided with growth in classes, growth in business, and that became employment area. That became the world in which then South Africa started growing. And I remember living through that Goldilocks period, thinking by myself, how long will this last? Because invariably, there has to be a recession and then it has to go back into growth. But we've literally lapsed ourselves into a world where there is just so much policy uncertainty. I want to add to, and this is from an investment perspective. So, you know, France comes from a policy perspective. From an investment perspective, I want to say that it almost feels to me like almost everything is up for grabs. There's question marks around absolutely everything. It's a bit like we've arrived at this point and policymakers are prepared to question absolutely everything, including if they've actually worked in the past. I mean, if you just think about it, we're talking about Reserve Bank autonomy. Is it right? Is it wrong? We're talking about monetary policy. What should it be? Should it be inflation targeting? Maybe we should just drop interest rates to 2% or 1% and hope for the best. We're talking about exchange controls, which will just be the next natural place to potentially go. We're talking about prescribed asset lists, potentially in non-discretionary assets. What about SOE funding? All of these kind of things are all of a sudden all up for grabs, and they're all questions that need answering. And questions, when you have questions that need answering, it doesn't make for an investment environment where there's confidence. And that is a little bit for me of what 2019 holds.
More uncertainty. But perhaps if I can just focus in on one issue to try and tease out some of the trade-offs here, France. Let's hone in on the national minimum wage, because I've heard some commentators say that it was necessary in order for the president to achieve a trade-off at NEDLAC with Labour to ensure that we had things like secret strike ballots, that we had interest arbitration inserted into the law to ensure that we couldn't have a repeat of what happened in the Rustenburg Platinum Belt, where we had AMCU holding an entire sector to ransom. And therefore, this was his quid pro quo, and that now we might see a far more moderate Labour environment.
Well, that's very much the problem. The argument that if Mr. Ramaphosa or any who are inclined to reform within his government or his party want to take a step towards reform, they have to give something away on the other side. And when you're a country that's seen government debt levels double in a decade, budget surplus transformed into a shortfall that's on par with what was recorded at the end of the apartheid era, when you're growing at 20% of the average rate of emerging markets around the world, when your maths and science performance is ranks towards the bottom of international rankings, when your level of unemployment is a multiple of that of comparable economies, you don't have the room and the space to make those deals. You need firm leadership on policy reform and to take a hard line on those elements, such as some trade unions, not all, that would prevent South Africa from breaking the structural unemployment deadlock. And if even at this late stage you're not in a position to force that kind of reform, then the rest of the story writes itself. And then I'm afraid our analysis of the unlikelihood of much materializing in terms of reform this year is going to halt. We're not in a position to afford these trade-offs, and the costs are paid by unemployed people. Half of young people do not have a job. If you listen to the way in which NEDLAC speaks about the minimum wage, or the way that Business Unity writes about it in Business Day this morning as a breakthrough between the social partners, you would think why not great numbers of unemployed people, half of young people unemployed, slightly more, who because of that minimum wage will probably now lose their last chance at getting low wage employment in the formal sector. And they cannot just as easily be written off as that, because they themselves will not allow it. And the destabilizing influence of that number of unemployed young people is something that is going to have a very real impact on all our lives and all our futures in the decade that lies ahead.
That speaks to a demographic trend, and perhaps you can also pick up on this, Kirby, from an investment perspective, that seems to indicate the ANC's on a potentially very difficult wicket here. If we're talking about the polls that are done by the likes of the IRR and others, it does seem to be that the more urban and the more educated voter is starting to question the ANC a whole lot more, not necessarily guaranteeing their vote. And what we see is in the hinterland and in the rural areas, that is where the ANC stronghold still lies. As we see a youth dividend and an unemployed youth bulge growing disaffected with the ANC, that could potentially be quite destabilizing to the country, politically speaking.
I agree. Yes, it can be destabilizing. But remember, on the other side, on the flip side of this, is when one gets this right from a policy perspective, ultimately, then this becomes, as you've rightly pointed out, becomes the economic dividend. That's why fund managers want to be invested in Africa and in South Africa in particular. That is why people look at the FMCG good companies in this country as investment destinations. Now, unfortunately, many of those investment cases are underwater and are very cheap relative to their global peers, predominantly because there isn't just the certainty around these issues. But it takes, let me put it to you this way. You know, if you look at the JSE All Share and you look at the valuation for the JSE All Share on its aggregate basis, you're looking at a valuation that looks fair. If you look at mid caps and small caps, those are very cheap. And in many cases, they're almost too cheap. We've seen cases last year where if a management team has the money, they have the ability to take their business private and buy it back from the listed shareholders because they have just become so cheap. Now, from an environment perspective, you only need a little bit of good news in order to ensure that there's a reversion in the valuation in many of those equities. And that could happen very, very, very quickly. Now, that is why, and just again from an asset perspective, that is why diversification is just so critical as far as asset management is concerned. You know, one of the things that I hear clients say to me is, why don't we just sell all the equities? I'm done. I've had enough. On a five-year basis, on a compounded basis, I've made less money than just leaving my money in cash. Why not sell? And my answer always is because nowhere at the bottom or the top does the market ring the bell and tell us to get back in. I just don't know about that. Mm-hmm. And the environment can change fundamentally very, very quickly. It needs a little bit of good news in order to have the reversion that happens.
Now, what we have painted is a scenario via France that is certainly not good news. It certainly doesn't paint a picture of a ruling party that is confronted by the potential loss of its power at the polls and therefore doesn't have the systemic pressure with which to fuel its reform. France, why doesn't the whole state capture Farago currently playing itself out in public at the Zondo Commission? Why doesn't that provide the impetus to reform? Surely there are those inside the ANC and the ruling party that realize they were basically selling the state to the highest possible bidder, and that if reform wasn't implemented, that we were going to end up like Zimbabwe in 10 years rather than 20.
You made the comment earlier about the good guys and the bad guys, and that's a position that cemented a lot of the analysis of what's happening in the country over the past 2 to 3 years, that there were the state capture culprits and they were the bad guys, they were corrupt, they stole money, and then there were the good guys who were trying to stop them. And if the good guys won, then the country would get back onto the trajectory that it was last on in the sort of 2004-07 era, when we grew at 5% for four consecutive years. The first time we'd done that since 1970. But that's not right, because the division isn't the good guys versus the bad guys. There are two check boxes we want reformers to check. One is on governance, the rule of law, accountability and corruption, prosecuting corrupt officials. And many on the anti-Zuma side did tick that box. But there's a second box as well, and that's that you're a pragmatist on policy. You're a reformist. You're not a lay Marxist or a hard left ideologue. And many of the guys that sat on the good guy side of the divide held positions on policy and ideology, such as the minimum wage, such as expropriation, which are fundamentally hostile to investment and certainty, and do in their own way as much damage as state capture. And we need to address both problems. And I think a lot of the writing and analysis has tended to emphasize the one over the other, to the extent that if we resolve the former, governance and corruption, the latter will follow. And that's not necessarily the case. And I think that's some of what we're starting to see in the Ramaphosa administration.
And if we look at signs, Kirby, of how further reforms might be negotiated, if we're to say, come May, and we still don't know the date of the election, but it's largely believed it or expected it should be in May, if we look at how the mining charter, for example, was negotiated, here we've had it. It's been touted as a success. The Minerals Council has come out and it's highlighted some of the improvements. The UBS report that I've seen reckons that it struck a good balance between government and civil society and industry, and it's produced sort of an acceptable outcome because everyone is equally unhappy with it, but we have some certainty at least. I still don't see mining executives, mining deal makers and rainmakers falling over each other to put deals together on the back of policy certainty, which we finally have. So we can have policy certainty, but if we've got the wrong policy, we're still not making ourselves an awfully attractive investment destination.
Yeah, plus, I mean, interlace that with commodity prices. You know, so commodities generally make money and do very well when you almost when you have what is called these super cycles happening in commodity prices. And we're certainly not sitting in an environment where there's a super cycle building in commodities. Or should I rather say, it doesn't seem to be a super cycle that we're in at this stage. When there's lots of money flowing around, then it makes the margins look a lot better despite the policy and despite what's going on at the bottom levels. Because you can appease. You can say to labor unions, look, you want this type of increase, but we'll give you that plus a little bit more or just slightly less, but everybody's happy because escalation happens on a continuous basis because your commodity prices is literally bailing you out. The problem that we've got in South Africa is that where skill exists, we almost manufacture or we almost impart that skill, but we don't have to necessarily employ people to do so because it's the knowledge economy. It's not a manufacturing base. Much of what we do in South Africa is almost directly linked to commodity prices, and we are almost at the mercy of what happens internationally rather than what happens here in South Africa. And this is part of the problem that we have in South Africa. The thing that exasperates a lot of what we're doing here, that we're speaking about here this evening, is the fact that from a capital perspective, we've seen the end of quantitative easing internationally. So we've seen capital flowing back to its sources and almost back to kind of the big G7 and away from emerging markets. And as that occurs, it lays bare the inadequacies in the system. And when you look at it, and this is what we're doing here this evening, we're looking at the inadequacies of the system, and it's not pretty. Why? Well, because we don't have capital to kind of froth over it, and so that it can look better. And this is, policymakers do one of two things. They either look at this and say, okay, it's bare and it's ugly, but we're going to do something about it, and that's the end of 2019. Or alternatively, you end up in a situation where we just bumble along. A little bit of what we've seen in 2018 and 2017 and 2016. And that'll probably be the worst, because the ultimate outcome for that is that we have to get bailed out. And I don't know if those kind of terms are going to be terms that the South African government is going to like.
When your policymakers were schooled in Moscow, though, as our Minister of Trade and Industry, our Minister of Public Enterprises, and our Minister of Energy, and I can go on and on, were all former or current card-carrying members of the Communist Party. Doesn't seem like we'll have the courage to make those policy choices that are pro-growth and pro-business, though, Kirby.
Well, you know, again, and this is the point I was thinking about when Franz spoke about just now, is that from an ideological perspective, South Africa is at war with itself. What is the ideology? What is it that we're supposed to be? We don't take the very best that we can see in the world and what we see with other types of economies, and we say, well, maybe we should be doing more of this.
We wanted to be a developmental state, and I think we still want to be a developmental state if you read sort of the NDP and even the ANC's manifesto. And Franz, perhaps you can shed some light on this for me, on why we have failed so miserably at being a developmental state, a la, I don't know, China or even Japan, post the World Wars and the Japanese Ministry of Trade and Industry. It played a central role in driving the economy forward.
In many respects, we haven't. We've been successful as a developmental state. The proportion of families in a formal house has increased vastly. The number of households with access to running water most of the time, or electricity most of the time, is sharply up. Our famous IRR soundbite is, for every shack built after 1994, more than 10 formal houses were built. So where it comes to transferring wealth from the middle classes into desperately poor households in order to uplift them, and to do that transfer via the state, we actually achieved a fair amount. We highlight this in a series of reports about the progress the country has made over the past 20 years. But in terms of being a modern industrial state and positioning ourselves as a competitive investment destination, there we've done very badly. And part of the reason for that is capacity within the civil service, which shouldn't have become such a constraint on the country's progress given the superb levels of capacity and professionalism in our private sector. had the private sector been engaged to help address developmental issues, we might have made even more progress. But the key obstacle remained and has increasingly become that of ideology, that development must be centered around the state, and particularly as the prospect of a future defeat dawns within the ANC, the sense grows ever more strongly that freeing people to a point where they are no longer dependent on the largesse of the state may very well accelerate the decline of the ruling party. And if we delve very deep into some of the polling that we've conducted, and the thousands and thousands of data points, but one of the pictures that's starting to emerge for me and how I read that data is that in this next election, probably less than half of people who vote ANC will come from urban areas. Less than half of people with matric express an interest in voting for the ANC. Just over a quarter of people with a university education, and we can go on by your level of income and employment, urban or rural, and that the ANC has surrendered a lot of the future potential voting market. It sustains itself on the poorer, more dependent, more rural market of the past 20 years. And the horrific realization, if you're not in the reformist camp of the ANC, is that the very manifestation of the better life for all, the thing that you probably did more to achieve than you realize, if you read some of our reports and one of the answers to one of your questions this evening, is that that very better life for all is busy feeding the ranks of the opposition, that in time, given demographic trends, is likely to secure a future ANC defeat. And if you're a slightly sinister chap and schooled, as you suggest, then one of your immediate reactions to that threat is to clamp down on freedom of expression, individual liberty and the like, in the hope that that will sustain your political hegemony for longer than might otherwise be the case.
And that is a scenario that is too frightening to even consider if you look at what's going on in Zimbabwe at the moment, reading some of the letters that came out of the country last week. With individuals experiencing conditions that one doesn't even see during wartime, the lack of access to the internet and communications and the outside world. And unfortunately, that is also the time we have for tonight. Absolutely sobering scenario planning there by Frans Cronier, CEO of the South African Institute of Race Relations, and Kobi Lekhranji, the co-founder of Rexlom Invest, giving us the asset manager's perspective on how one builds a portfolio and builds an investment case around this kind of uncertainty. Very difficult to do.